From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Timothy Treadwell lived among grizzly bears for 13 summers before he met a tragic end. Treadwell documented his experiences on video. On today's Fresh Air, filmmaker Werner Herzog tells us how he took Treadwell's footage and combined it with his own insights to create the documentary Grizzly Man. It's just come out on video. The show American Idol begins its fifth season on Tuesday. We'll hear from the cruel and clever judge of American Idol, Simon Cowell. He also co-created the show. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new French film, Cachet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Werner Herzog, was a leader of the new wave of German cinema following World War II. Herzog has always been interested in physical and emotional extremes, and in recent years he's focused on documentaries. His latest, Grizzly Man, tells the story of Timothy Treadwell, an American who devoted himself to learning about and living among Alaskan grizzly bears. Herzog's film draws heavily on video diaries Treadwell kept, describing his life with the bears.
Most times I'm a kind warrior out here. Most times I am gentle. I am like a flower. I'm like a fly on the wall, observing, noncommittal, non-invasive in any way. Occasionally I am challenged, and in that case, the kind warrior must become a samurai, must become so formidable, so fearless of death, so strong that you will win. You will win. Even the bears will believe that you are more powerful. And in a sense, you must be more powerful if you are to survive in this land with the bear.
After 13 summers among the bears, in 2003, Treadwell and his companion Amy Huguenard were attacked and killed by a grizzly. Grizzly Man has earned Best Documentary or Nonfiction Film Awards from the Los Angeles, New York, and Toronto Film Critics Associations. Among Herzog's best-known feature films are Aguirre, the Wrath of God, about a mad Spanish conquistador, Nosferatu, a retelling of the Dracula story, and Fitzcarraldo, about a man obsessed with building an opera house in the Amazon jungle. The DVD of his latest documentary, Grizzly Man, has just been released. I spoke to Herzog last summer when it first appeared in theaters. I asked Herzog what Timothy Treadwell was trying to accomplish by living among grizzly bears.
Well, I think only he would have the answer, but unfortunately he's dead, and we can only try to read from and understand from his letters, diaries, photos and video material that he has left. But apparently he saw himself in a great mission to save the bears, who apparently didn't need that much redemption or saving because they were relatively well protected in Katmai, in this case, Katmai National Park, a federal national park. But he was also a great educator. He taught school children over the years, tens of thousands all in all, for free, never solicited a fee, so he was on a real mission. But I do believe that he probably didn't save the bears that much as the bears saved him. He was a deeply troubled man, haunted by demons. He was an alcoholic, I mean, in a severe stage of alcoholism, and he speaks about it himself. And he had a near-fatal overdose, apparently heroin. So, and coming across the wild nature out there in Alaska and seeing the grizzly bears, that was like an epiphany for him. And he said to himself, I must protect the bears. This is the great mission in my life. All of a sudden, and he says so in the film, he has a life. Now, I think the bears redeemed him more than he redeemed the bears.
You know, I was going to play a clip from the film. This is from one of Timothy Treadwell's video diaries in which he talks a bit about kind of what this mission in his life has brought him. Let's listen to this. This, again, is from my guest Werner Herzog's new documentary, Grizzly Man.
I have no idea if there's a God, but if there's a God, God would be very, very pleased with me. If you could just watch me here, how much I love them, how much I adore them, how respectful I am to them, how I am one of them, and how the studies they give me, the photographs, the video, and take that around for no charge to people around the world. It's good work. I feel good about it. I feel good about myself doing it. And I want to continue, and I hope I can. I really hope I can. But if not, be warned. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. Thank you so much for letting me do this. Thank you so much for these animals, for giving me a life. I had no life. Now I have a life.
And that was Timothy Treadwell from my guest Werner Herzog's new documentary, Grizzly
How
Man.
How tragic to hear this voice, because very shortly after that, he was killed and devoured by a grizzly bear together with his girlfriend. It makes me ache when I hear his voice like that.
It is interesting that he survives 13 summers of the bears, living in close proximity to grizzly bears. But the summer that he perishes comes on an occasion in which he stays later than he normally would. Does it seem likely that he might have been killed not by the bears who he had come to know well over 13 seasons, but by other bears who were out late, probably hungrier?
Yes. And wilder and not as much accustomed to the presence of a human being. When he returns, he writes in his diary, most of his bear friends were gone into hibernation, and wilder, scarier, more aggressive bears, hungrier bears, big bears from the backcountry had moved in and taken over the stream where there was a last little bit of the salmon run.
He shot more than 100 hours of video. I think was used to running the video camera at all kinds of encounters with the bears. And as it happens, a video camera was running in this last tragic attack when both Treadwell and his girlfriend, Amy Huguenard, were killed by the bear. The video camera was running, but with the lens cap on. So, in effect, there was an audio record of the attack itself. Now, we don't hear that audio in your film, but you do listen to it. Tell us, was it your decision or someone else's not to air that audio? How did you decide to use that in the film?
It was very easy to decide this because I listened to it in presence of the guardian or the custodian of Treadwell's materials, Jewel Palovac, who had founded Grizzly People, a non-profit organization, together with Treadwell, and she's holding all the rights to his books and photos and videos and so. And she allowed me to listen to it, and it was instantly clear for me, under no circumstances whatever, that is going to be published. Number one, it was clear to me we are not doing a snuff movie. Number two, it occurred to me instantly, you have to respect the privacy of and the dignity of an individual death. You don't drag it into the open. So not permissible, and of course Jewel Palovac wouldn't have agreed either, even though she never listened to the tape, and she has not done so until this very day.
You tell us at the end of this film that Treadwell's story isn't so much about nature, which he seems to think it is, but a look into ourselves and our nature, and this gives his life meaning. What does his story tell us about ourselves?
Well, it certainly is not a film about wild nature. I ignore much of that footage, and he has dozens and dozens of hours of fluffy bear cubs with playing with mom bear, and he has dozens and dozens of hours of bear fishing for salmon and bears roaming the landscape and so. But the real interesting side of what he filmed, because he pointed his own camera at himself very, very often. He wanted to be a movie star. He was actually a failed movie star as well. Tried to get into some TV soap operas and shows like Cheers. And he wanted to be a star and points the camera at himself. And now all of a sudden we gain insight into the human nature, into the human heart, their souls, into our human condition more than anything I've seen in a long, long, long time. And that's a great value of his footage. And it's all his turmoil. It's him being haunted by demons, him in exhilarations, in joy, in jubilation, dejected, in self-deceit, in moments of paranoia, in moments of victory, in moments of defeat. Everything that's human life, human existence, human condition, and it's wonderful that we have that. And that makes him so big, that he is way, way, way beyond a wildlife cinematographer.
In recent years, you've done a lot of more documentaries, and I was curious about, as someone who has spent so much time in feature films, creating an image from scratch, if it's a different skill to tell a story where you are capturing and editing images in reality. You don't like cinema verite, where you just present a chronicle.
Yeah, I think Cinema Verite somehow doesn't make a clear enough distinction between fact and truth, as if facts constituted truth. But there's quite a distinction that I make. And I'm after something that you find in great poetry. When you read a great poem, you would instantly notice that there's a deep truth in it. You don't have to analyze the poem in academic ways and all this. You know it instantly, and it passes on to you and becomes part of your inner existence. And it's the same thing in cinema. In great moments of cinema, you are hit and struck by some sort of enlightenment, by something that illuminates you. And it's a deep form of truth, and I call it an ecstatic truth, the ecstasy of truth. And that's what I'm after, and I'm after that in documentaries, in feature films. And in documentaries, you can't even call my documentaries documentaries, because I fabricate, I invent, I write dialogues for it. So the borderline between documentary and feature films is quite blurred and doesn't exist like this for me.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was that in your documentaries, it is your vision, and we hear your voice and we hear your ideas. And I'd like to play just a bit of your voiceover from your recent documentary, Grizzly Man. This is my guest, yes, Werner Herzog. And I will just tell our audience that, although it's not critical to my point, in this particular piece of the voiceover, we are seeing a close-up of a large grizzly bear who at times looks directly into the camera.
And what haunts me is that in all the faces of all the bears that Treadwell ever filmed, I discover no kinship, no understanding, no mercy. I see only the overwhelming indifference of nature. To me, there is no such thing as a secret world of the bears. And this blank stare speaks only of a half-bored interest in food. But for Timothy Treadwell, this bear was a friend, a savior.
You know, of the five or six moments in the film that really stuck with me, that was one of them. What do you think your voice brings to your documentary films?
I think there is, for the audience, a person recognizable behind the movie. It's not just an anonymous film that you normally would see on TV and you hear a well-polished voice in the studio and done by an actor. Here you can identify the human being behind the film. And you even see me once for something like 30 seconds on screen, but from behind. So I thought this was right and good, and don't hide in anonymity behind your movie.
Veteran filmmaker Werner Herzog, Grizzly Man is now out on DVD. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new documentary, Grizzly Man, tells the story of Timothy Treadwell, a self-taught American naturalist who lived among Alaskan grizzly bears and was eventually killed by one. Herzog has directed more than 50 films and was a leader of German cinema in the post-war period. Several of his feature films starred the temperamental actor Klaus Kinski. Two were set deep in the Amazon jungle, Aguirre, the Wrath of God, about a crazed Spanish conquistador, and Fitzcarraldo, in which a man obsessed with bringing opera to the jungle hires hundreds of Indians to haul a massive steamship over a mountain to reach his rubber plantation. Anyone who has seen the documentary, the Les Blank documentary, Burden of Dreams, right, which is about, it's a remarkable film about your making of your film, Fitzcarraldo, which for audience who haven't seen it, it tells you a three-year epic and all the difficulties you overcame filling this incredible story deep in the Amazonian jungle. And your star then was Klaus Kinski, who, as you note, was legendary for his tantrums and rages. I wanted to ask you, since Klaus Kinski on this set, when you were making Fitzcarraldo, there were many, many times when people had to wait for days at times, weeks, yeah. And he would go into these rages. And you also had, in addition to the European cast there, you had scores, maybe hundreds of indigenous people, Indians, who
sure.
were observing yeah. this raving madman actor. How did they react to Kinski?
Well, they would normally huddle and whisper, and then they would fall silent. They would form a circle with their backs out there, and they would huddle, and they were kind of afraid. The funny thing is that the chief of all these tribal people came to me after one of those mad rages, raving and ranting of Kinski and screaming for hours. He came to me and he said, you have probably noticed that we were kind of afraid. And he says, but don't you believe that we were afraid of this raging madman who is screaming about? They were afraid of me because I was so quiet. They were really afraid of me.
Right.
You see, and in the same movie, I had to...
Right.
to hoist a huge steamboat in one single piece over a mountain with 1,100 savage, quote-unquote, savage Indians, and with no technology, literally no modern technology. And that boat weighed a couple of hundred tons, and I don't know if you can imagine what that means. So, and we had two plane crashes, and we had all sorts of things, and Kinski screaming and yelling and throwing tantrums every 2 hours. So you gotta live with it, and you gotta somehow fortify yourself with enough philosophy.
Did the Indians ever offer you any help with Kinski?
Yeah, well, they wanted to kill him, and they asked me, shall we kill him for you? And I said, no, I'm still shooting. I still need him. It is not a joke.
Right.
They would have done it in 10 seconds flat.
You know, one of my favorite of your movies, in fact, one of my favorite of anybody's movies, is Strozek. And it's this tale of this man who gets out of prison of man, I guess one might say, of diminished mental capacity. He hooks up with an abused prostitute and an eccentric old man, and they make their way to, of all places, Wisconsin to start a new life. And it's just a remarkable story. And one of the interesting things about this is that the lead in this, who plays this disheveled man, is a gentleman by the name of Bruno S., right, who was not an actor
right.
at all. Now tell us about what you saw in him and what brought him into your movies.
I saw him by coincidence in a documentary made by a young Berlin filmmaker, a film student, about marginal people who are doing street singing, and he was one of them. And I instantly knew that man had to be the leading character in Kaspar Hauser. Actually, in fact, he was a forklift driver in a steel factory, but he had spent 23 years locked away between his third year of age until he was 26. What happened was he was the son of a prostitute who didn't want this child. And she beat up that baby so severely all over the for no reasons whatsoever. And when he was 3 years old and he was speaking already, she beat him so savagely that he lost speech, and that was a pretext for her to get rid of him, and she put him into an asylum for retarded and insane children. And he spent something like 6 years there until he was nine, started to escape, was recaptured, ended up in correctionals and in some sort of mild forms of prison, and then he had a long career of minor offenses, vagabondry or breaking open a car in winter when it was bitterly cold and he was homeless. And he would sleep in a car and police would drag him out, and he got 4 months in jail for that. So for 23 years he was locked away and systematically somehow destroyed by society. And he had an illuminating power inside of him, which you cannot describe unless you see the movies. And he never wanted to have his name released. I said to him, you are the anonymous the unknown soldier of cinema, and I want to construct the monument for the unknown soldier for you.
What was he like to work with on a movie set? I mean, clearly not someone who was a trained actor and who brought a lot of difficulties.
Complicated, because he had moments of utmost despair and would talk to me in the middle of a shot, just look at me and start talking to me for 2.5 hours. Of course, the camera would stop, and I insisted that the entire crew would freeze in their positions and listen attentively what he was saying to me. He needed that, and I took the time, and I was okay to guide him, and his work in these two movies I made is unprecedented in depth and in beauty.
And what became of him after those two movies?
He never wanted to become a movie star, but he, of course, he became better known, and the barber gives him a free haircut, and the pastry baker drags him in and gives him a cake whenever he walks by, and they are proud of him. It improved the climate around him. And he actually worked as a street singer on weekends, during the week as a forklift driver. And he retired. He retired a couple of years, and he lives on pension now in Berlin.
Well, Werner Herzog, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Veteran filmmaker Werner Herzog. His latest documentary, Grizzly Man, has just been released on DVD. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the wickedly witty judge of American Idol, Simon Cowell. The show begins its fifth season on Tuesday. And we'll hear a review of the new French film, Cachet. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. American Idol begins its fifth season on Tuesday, and once again we'll be treated to some awful singing by people who think they're quite talented. And we'll hear the blunt, some would say cruel, criticisms of the show's most controversial judge, Simon Cowell. He's not just a judge. He co-created the phenomenon, which started with the British TV show Pop Idol. He's now executive at BMG Records. Last season, the winner of American Idol was Carrie Underwood. Her album, Some Hearts, is number one on Billboard's country chart, and her second single, Jesus Take the Wheel, is also number one. It's the 87th number one single by a past contestant on American Idol. Let's hear Carrie Underwood's Jesus Take the Wheel.
She was driving last Friday on her way to Cincinnati on a snow-white Christmas Eve. going home to see your mama and her daddy with the baby in the back seat. 50 miles to go and she was running low on faith and gasoline. It'd been a long, hard year. She had a lot on her mind and she didn't pay attention. She was going away too fast. And before she knew it, she was spinning on a thin black sheet of glass. She saw both her lives flash before her eyes. She didn't even have time to cry. She was so scared. She threw her hands up in the Jesus, take the
singer Carrie Underwood. Terry Gross spoke with Simon Cowell in 2004.
Now, on American Idol, you've seen a lot of very bad singers. What do you think makes bad singers think that they're good?
Oh, God. I wish I could explain that. I can't answer that, but I can, I think, answer why these people enter a competition like American Idol. Because I think today, more than any other time in history, we live in what I call a fame epidemic. Whereas when I was at school, I'm 44, when you asked people in my class what you wanted to be when you left school, most of the girls would reply nurse, and most of the boys would reply racing driver or train driver. Ask that same question today, and I think most of the replies would be famous. And I think that's partly because of just the type of magazines which are popular at the moment. They are broadcasting the type of lives you could have if you become famous. And it's just encouraged everybody now to chase that dream.
Boy, you're really feeding into that, though, aren't you, with American Idol? Particularly, like, there's videos in it where all of the contestants talk about what it's like to ride in a limo and to get the makeover and to have somebody do your makeup and to sign autographs. And it's like, oh, boy, maybe I'll be famous, too, one day.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but I think the show works because, in other words, one feeds off the other at the moment, I think, Terry. I love the idea of giving somebody 15 minutes of fame and actually taking it away. I do. I love it.
Why do you like the taking it away part?
I don't know. I'm just quite sadistic, really, Terry.
It sounds that way, actually.
But that's, you know, that, of course, we are giving them the ultimate torture, as you quite rightly say. We put them in the mansion and we give them the limousine, and their fate now is determined by somebody picking up the telephone or not picking up the telephone.
Did you know right away that you were going to, as a judge, be rude or totally honest, depending on how you want to look at it? But did you know that that's what your persona was going to be?
I didn't really think about it too much, actually, Terry. I got so caught up in the development of the show in the UK, I hadn't really given my role too much thought. And in fact, when we started auditioning the very first day on the very first British show, it was just terrible because we all kind of got camera fright and became very polite. So the first hour of TV was just atrocious. And in the end, I had to take out one of my fellow judges out the room and say, this is just awful because I'm just dying in there because all the things I want to say, I'm not saying. So I think we should just behave as we would in a normal audition and walk back in the room. And from that moment on, it all changed.
Well, no, wait a minute. At a normal audition, do you speak that honestly to the person who's auditioning, or is that how you talk after they leave the room?
If I'm being honest, we're worse, because in a normal audition, someone will open the door and will just say leave before they even start.
Oh, really? Why, based on their hair or something?
Yeah, just on the way they look, on everything. You just know. If you're auditioning for something specific and somebody walks in who you know is just not suitable, I mean, it's like the door opens, leave. You could argue that perhaps, you know, in real life auditions, people people are treated a little bit more harshly.
One of the things I found very interesting about watching American Idol is that, in a way, it's a catalog of all the bad mannerisms that have seeped into pop music. Like, if you watch the show enough, you can see all of the things that have gone wrong in pop music that people are picking up on and trying to emulate.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like that kind of melisma where you're singing around the note and up and down and around the note and embellishing a lot without doing a good job of it, without really adding anything, and it becomes really annoying. It just becomes pure mannerism. There's a lot of that on the radio. There was a lot of that in American Idol, too.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that way, that you're watching this kind of catalog of things that have gone wrong in pop music?
100%. Because like you, Terry, I loathe that kind of singing. Because for me, when you listen to some of the great singers like Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, these guys never sang like that, but they were just amazing singers. It's almost an affectation now because you're not supposed to sing like that. I absolutely loathe it. But I was talking to the girl who brought me down from the publishing house earlier on, just basically saying, which we both said, how much we dislike music on the radio at the moment because it's so monotonous.
I just want to make it clear that I don't think all singing around the note is bad. It's just that there's a certain kind of pointless embellishment that's really
annoying. Look, it's like people coming in, Terry, where they try and copy an artist so accurately that they even sing the ad-libs.
Right, right.
And you try and explain what an ad-lib is. You know, it's not part of the song, it's an ad-lib. And they do it in their audition. I mean, it drives me nuts. And there aren't too many Frank Sinatras or Ella Fitzgeralds around at the moment to copy. They are copying bad singers in the first place. And, of course, it becomes like some ghastly Xerox machine. You know, the original isn't very good and the copies are even worse. But, you know, Terry, look, if I'm being honest with you, the show works because of its imperfections.
Right.
If it was a perfect show, it would be boring.
How much of a say do the singers have in which songs they do?
It is totally down to them. I mean, you know, Terry, we could sit there week on week really helping them with their choice of songs, choice of arrangements, what they wear. But the fun, as the show continues, is watching the contestants getting it right and, of course, watching it get them wrong. For instance, when Clay sang that ghastly version of Grease on American Idol 2 and came running out in that awful red leather jacket, you just think, what are you doing? But that's, again, you know, the appeal of the show is that some weeks they get it right and often they get it wrong.
American Idol co-creator and judge Simon Cowell speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with American Idol judge Simon Cowell. The show's fifth season begins next week.
You know, American Idol is really just like an incredible marketing machine. You know, you put the people on TV. By the time the series is over, the person who wins is a star. Then they make the record. So there's already an audience waiting for the record before the record's even released. And then after the first season, there was the movie. Now there, you
don't
know,
mention it.
What's that? Don't mention it. That was the big failure, wasn't it?
Yeah. God almighty. But the funny thing was, I remember when the producer told me the name of the film, and he said it's called From Justin to Kelly. I said, have you ever heard of a director called Ed Wood? And he said, no. And I said, well, it sounds like the title of one of his films, because it sounds like a transvestite movie from Justin to Kelly. He didn't get the joke. And it ended up looking like an Ed Wood movie. Big mistake.
Well, couldn't you have stopped it?
No. Absolutely not. I mean, there are certain people who, you know, who are involved with the artists who can do what the hell they want. I mean, I can hold my hand up as the record label and say, big mistake here, guys. But, you know, they learn their lessons.
Now, early in your career as a record producer, you know how to market things. You called the World Wrestling Foundation and suggested you do an album with you know, Randy Macho Man Savage and some of the other WWF guys, not because they were great singers, but because they had an audience who would buy their products. So you had a built-in market.
Yes. Yeah. It was just common sense. They'd come over to the UK.
Let me just say it's the World Wrestling Federation, not Foundation.
Federation, yeah. You're absolutely right.
It sounds like a non-profit organization the way I said it.
Believe me, that's not. they came over to London, and I read in one of our newspapers that they'd sold out 82,000 seats in 27 minutes. Oh, hang on a minute. There's not a rock band in the world who can do that. And I also found out that they were selling about 2.5 million videos a year to the fans who watched the show. So it didn't take a lot of time to realize that if they were selling that many seats and that many videos, that there would be a lot of kids who'd want to buy an album from the wrestlers as well. It was just common sense.
But did it ever make you think, but I'm not being true to my musical love. I'm just doing this as pure marketing.
What do you think, Terry?
Give me the money.
Give me the money. And, you know, it's a funny thing about the music industry, which I think it's quite unusual, because I think in television and film, it's readily accepted that both TV and film has to survive as an industry by selling to all sorts of demographics. I mean, you have children's TV, you have more serious TV, you have mass market TV. My theory about the music industry is that why shouldn't we run the record label with that concept, which is, of course, you can have the more credible, serious stuff, but why shouldn't a younger audience be able to buy music they like, which isn't necessarily the most artistic form on earth, but they love when they buy it? I mean, I've never seen the sense of being snobbish about music. You either like it or you don't.
So there's versions of American Idol now in 21 countries. What are some of the most interesting differences between what the singers in each of those countries are like? You know, how they perform, what their mannerisms are, what really irks you about them?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Nothing changes all over the world, Terry. You know, it's if you took away, you know, the talking part, it's really difficult, probably with the exception of Lebanon, which is fairly ghastly, Lebanon Idol. That's almost a contradiction in terms, isn't it? But that's why I think the show works as a universal show, which is that the same rules apply. Most of the people who turn up are terrible. Every single person believes they are God's gift to the music industry. So they are the same.
Does every country cover Stevie Wonder records?
Yes. Every country now. The funny thing was is that we, you know, as you know, started the show in England. And then when we sold it all over the world, every country tried to find somebody unpleasant on the judging panel. And
right.
that's quite bizarre. People who I've known for years as jolly nice people suddenly turning into complete pigs. and that's quite irritating.
Everyone who watches the show knows that part of the drama of American Idol is the tension between you and one of the other judges, Paula Abdul, who was a pop star in the 80s. And her persona on the show as a judge is somebody who's always supportive, even if she hates the singer. She'll find something nice and encouraging to say to them. And you're just the opposite. If something bothers you, you'll just bluntly say it. So you argue with each other on the show, and there's a whole constellation of jokes about your relationship. Did you know things would be like that? Because after you must have been in on hiring her in the first place, you created the show.
Well, when it was decided to hire Paula, you know, we all had a hand in the decision. And I only knew of her as a pop star, and I only met her for the first time when I walked into the audition room on that first day in Los Angeles, and I was introduced to her 20 or 30 minutes before the show started. It was Paula who, you know, kind of reacted strangely within the first hour of auditioning, because I don't think she quite knew what the show was going to be like. And I guess she thought we were all going to be like the people on Star Search and tell everybody they're great. And after the first three or four auditions, I mean, she was horrified, really horrified. And that did create a lot of tension.
When Paula Abdul became a judge on the show, did you feel like saying to some of the contestants on the show, this is what happens to pop stars 10, 20 years later? People don't know who they are anymore.
God, that's a good point. No, I didn't actually, but now you mentioned it, I think I might mention it. I.e., don't enter, this is what happens. But you know what? Funny enough, Terry, at the end of the day, I actually do like Paula, and because, you know, she's actually got a much, much harder job than I've got. It's easy for me to criticize all these people and to be rude. I would find it really hard to do what she does week after week, which is to try and see, you know, the bright side of things. I couldn't do it.
One more question. When a performer is doing what you consider to be a really bad job, you often accuse them of being like, performing like they should be at Six Flags or some other like theme park or amusement park. And but in some way, the type of pop singing that's done on American Idol seems to be the type of pop singing that would flourish at those parks but not have a home in a lot of other places. You know, the clubs that teenagers and college students go to don't have that kind of pop. And, you know, the expensive clubs like in Vegas have older performers. I know you've created venues for them, but was there a pre-existing venue for that type of pop, of people that age?
Probably not, no. I take the point you're saying, Terry, which is that you look as if you're contradicting yourself sometimes. The problem we had was simply this, is that if we had decided to bring in rap music and hip-hop music, I actually don't believe anybody would have watched this show. The only time we feel that we can keep an audience is when they are singing older songs in an older style. And you'll notice that all the people who've won this competition have never varied from that. I mean, one of our better singers, Tamyra Gray, she veered off slightly one week by singing something a bit more contemporary. And she was voted off the show.
Why? So why is that, do you think?
Because I honestly don't know. I think you could argue one of the reasons is because there is an older audience watching.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also say that even the younger kids who are watching, even though they don't like to admit it, they actually do like traditional old pop songs.
You know what I think it is, too? You take something like hip-hop. You're supposed to have a certain, like, street cred or authenticity, yeah, or something. And you're certainly not going to get street cred or authenticity by being on American Idol.
Listen, you've hit the nail on the head. And, you know, we had this supposed rocker on the show last year. His name was Patrick.
Mm-hmm.
But he was somebody who looked like he'd gone into the rock shop and said, make me a rock star. I mean, he just wasn't believable. And I described him as being a sheep in wolf's clothing and made the point, because when he said to me, I'm into rock and roll, I said, no, you're not, mate, because rock and roll is anti-establishment. This is establishment, this show. So just by the fact that you bothered to audition, you've told me very, very loud and clear, you are not rock and roll. But it's exactly the point you just made. You know, if you really are into that kind of music, you stay away from a show like American Idol.
Simon Cowell, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking to you, Terry.
Simon Cowell, the co-creator and judge of American Idol, speaking with Terry Gross. American Idol's fifth season opens Tuesday. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film Cachet. This is Fresh Air. The 63-year-old German director Michael Haneke has a reputation for exploring extreme and violent states of mind. Working in France for the last 5 years, he's made a series of films including La Pianiste, in which Isabelle Huppert plays a piano teacher given to voyeurism, sadism, and self-mutilation. Haneke's acclaimed new film, Cachet, won him the Best Director prize at last year's Cannes Film Festival. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
One thing I get to do as a critic is walk into a movie without knowing anything, not even the premise. And I love this. I love being disoriented and letting the filmmakers only gradually give me my bearings. Now, I realize I'm in the business of taking that pleasure away from you, and that's going to be especially true of Michael Haneke's Cachet, which is a strange hybrid of political parable, meditation on the video medium, and ghost story. And what's thrilling is our disorientation. So what I'll try to do is tell you some things about Cachet without taking away that sense of discovery. That's the best reason to see it. The first thing is that the movie plays with perspectives. It's tantalizing. Are we watching a video within a movie or real life? The realities often blur. The first shot is a long, static view of a city house with people coming and going. It turns out to be a tape mailed to the protagonist, Georges, played by Daniel Auteuil, and his wife Anne, played by Juliette Binoche. Who sent it? Why? Was it perhaps a crazed fan? Georges, after all, is a famous TV personality. He interviews authors on a highbrow show surrounded by formidable bookcases. Because cachet means hidden, let's switch for a moment to a genre that was once the province of horror films, but has lately been seeping into the mainstream. Call it the revenge of the repressed. Something once happened, an injustice, maybe cultural. In a Stephen King novel, or Poltergeist, it might be that developers dug up the graves of an Indian burial ground, or the protagonist committed a crime long ago, and now a demon has emerged from the depths of his unconscious. Post 9/11, this device has been adopted by liberal filmmakers. They've created scenarios that drive home the source of the third world's anger. The Constant Gardener, Syriana, Munich, even Crash, rub our noses in the West's willed ignorance. These filmmakers argue that to maintain our comfort and affluence, we've pushed our imperialism and racism out of our minds. We've cultivated a cultural and historical amnesia. At the core of Cachet's narrative is a Paris riot of October 1961, in which around 200 Algerian immigrants, protesting their disenfranchisement, were killed by the police. Now, what does Georges, the public face of the haute bourgeois intelligentsia, have to do with all this? Obviously something. The truth, as it turns out, is cruel, and some of the imagery grisly. And the source of those images is maddeningly hard to pin down. It's impossible to see Cachet and not think of the riots that tore up French cities a few months ago. Haneke was almost supernaturally prescient. But the movie has a serious flaw, which is that its protagonist has no stature as a dramatic character. Georges relives his past in dreams, avenging dreams, the last of which will haunt you for a long time. But he remains stubborn in his denial. Haneke never lets him rise to the occasion. He has too much contempt for him, which I think is an example of an artist putting politics ahead of drama. But cachet does point the way for mainstream directors to use genre devices to explore the politics of forgetting. And that's something film can do with more psychological complexity than the news media and more visceral kick than literature. It can show us the cost of the hidden, the ever-escalating rent on those locked storage rooms of the mind.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. On the web at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, it's Martin Luther King Day. We talk about the final 3 years of King's life with Taylor Branch. He's completed the last volume of his trilogy about America during the King years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.